You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent, incoming editor-in-chief. I'm here with...
Jim O'Quinn, outgoing editor-in-chief.
Susie Evans, I'm the senior editor.
Deep Tran, associate editor.
Yeah, Jim, we're doing a slow motion or a quick version of the Lou Cerebellumi transition here, where we're both editor-in-chief at the same time. Those are the artistic directors at Penumbra who are handing over the reins over 5 years. So they're both artistic director, and she's sort of learning the ropes from him.
Her father.
Her father, Lou, yes, indeed.
Jim is not Rob's
Jim
father.
Jim is not my father.
Thank the Lord.
As far as I know.
That's a little edit, Dave.
Yeah,
that's
keep that in.
Room for space there for the pause.
Keep that in. That's good.
We actually have a piece about that that's going up around the same time this podcast about the transitions in Minneapolis. So a little plug there, Isaac Butler's piece about the many artistic director turnovers in Minneapolis. So look for that online. But, and Jim, can we talk about this turnover at all?
We're in the midst of another transition, aren't we?
Yeah.
And, perhaps when this issue is complete this week, I'll have time to think about what it means. But meanwhile, we've been working like crazy on a remarkable September issue of the magazine, headlined by Susie Evans' Tell It To Me Straight interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda, the genius behind Hamilton. That's the cover of the issue, but it's packed with lots of other good material, which we'll discuss as this interview proceeds.
Yeah, the Sybil Kempson profile. Anyway, lots of good stuff in the September issue that we are putting to bed this week. So, Jim, we were hashing stuff we've talked about many times before, but you started in 82, is that right? You were hired by TCG?
I was hired in TCG in the ancient days of 1982, out of graduate school at NYU, in order to begin work on creating a national theater magazine. Because I was not only a person interested in the theater and studying the theater, but I was a journalist and had a journalism background. We began 2 years of development of the magazine, and American Theater was launched in April 84.
Weren't you originally hired as to make a newsletter and you campaigned for a magazine?
Well, TCG was publishing a monthly newsletter, Theater Communications, and had been for several years. And the magazine, the newsletter was simply growing beyond its boundaries. It became fatter and fatter. And besides, the powers that be in those days, Peter Zeisler and Lindy Zesch, affectionately known as the Z's among the staff, were intent on making TCG a publisher of a national theater magazine. There hadn't been a general circulation magazine about the theater in America since the old Theater Arts Monthly folded in 1964, believe it or not. So that marks 20 years of no general circulation magazine about the theater in America. And I think Peter believed that nobody was better equipped than the National Service Organization for the Theater, TCG, to make that move.
I don't think I've asked this before. How big was the staff when you started, Jim? Was it you and...
It was me and Laura Ross.
Really?
There were sort of two of us. But we had our inimitable publications director, Terry Nemeth, supervising our efforts. In the development of the magazine, I mean, we had a wonderful set of distinguished collaborators on the planning process for the magazine, including people like John Hausman, Robert Brustein, and the great Canadian director John Hirsch, and the designer Marjorie Bradley Kellogg, a wonderful group of people planning the magazine. So that was a very interesting time.
I'm wondering, you know, because it started, it was a newsletter before it was a magazine. I mean, not American Theater, but there was a newsletter. And it is the magazine for the field, and it's supported by membership from all the theaters. I wonder about if you could talk a little bit about the mandate from the beginning and ever since to be an independent, as independent a voice as possible, and cover the scene with some independence. I know you've done a lot and thought a lot about that and inculcated that in all of us.
Well, yes, that's right. The original idea was that American Theater would be a publication for the profession, but it would extend to theater goers as well, to anyone interested in the art of the theater, much as the dance and music and opera publications are read by participants in that art form and fans of it. But over the years, we've discovered through our surveys and analyses that 80-plus percent of our readership consistently through the years have been members of the profession, people who teach theater, or students of theater. So we're pretty solidly a trade publication.
Right.
It's come down to that, and we've acknowledged that characteristic for the magazine.
I mean, one thing that we're seeing as a possibility with social media and the web is that we might have a chance to break through or break out of that mold a little bit. I mean,
I think that's going to be the case.
Yeah,
I think that's already the case with the website. Don't you?
Yeah, and at the very least, I hope what we attract are aspirants as much as and people attached or interested in the theater at some level. I mean, it's not a surprise that the people interested in theater happen to also be involved in on some level around the country.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
And that's vice versa. Right.
Here's something I always actually wondered, because we've been doing quite a bit of hiring and interviewing for positions here in the last couple of months, and the questions that Susie and I have been asking people are, how much do you know about the national theater scene? What artists are you looking for? And so, like, when you came in, Jim, did you know much about the national scene, or was it something that
endlessly at NYU? I think I was in graduate school there for 3.5 years, and in the performance studies department. So I was paying a lot of attention to theatrical matters. I was managing editor of the Drama Review for some of those years, and I was paying a lot of attention to what was going on in American theater and internationally. So I did have a bit of a finger on the pulse, but I think it was actually for my journalistic background that I was basically hired.
Yeah, I want to hear a little bit more about your journalistic background, because I know you worked at like a daily newspaper. What were kind of your early days in journalism?
Oh, well, I went into journalism well before Watergate, when you could actually graduate from college with a degree in journalism and get a job on a newspaper. I was early on a city desk reporter in the Times-Picayune in New Orleans.
Did you take down politicians too?
Well, I covered Mardi Gras balls, and and lots of serious news as well. Then I became a small town newspaper publisher. For a couple of years, I published an award winning weekly newspaper in Southwest Louisiana. I went on to work in other capacities in New Orleans. I was also in arts public relations and educational public relations for a time. I worked as the liaison between the press and the public at New Orleans Public Schools. I was the first public relations director for the Contemporary Arts Center in New Orleans. I was also a vaudeville piano player on Bourbon Street for a couple of 2.5 years doing a show there, during which time I did a lot of work in the theater. I was even briefly a professional theater person. I worked for the old New Orleans Repertory Theater of New Orleans, one of those early regional theaters that was established there. It lasted into the 70s, 1972, I believe, but I worked there as an apprentice actor under Miss June Havoc, the great June Havoc, as artistic director. So I had a checkered career in New Orleans before coming to moving up east to sort of legitimized my interest in the theater at NYU.
Well, and now the Repertory Theater in New Orleans was that was a recognizable model once your purview became the entire resident theater movement around the country. I mean, obviously you knew there was theater outside of New York, A, and B, there were other theaters like the Repertory Theater of New Orleans all around
absolutely,
the country.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Unfortunately, that particular theater didn't survive.
Right.
Miss Havoc left in 1972 after she said that, it was said that she did her best performances in front of the New Orleans City Council begging for money. But that money was not forthcoming, and that wonderful theatrical experiment folded. But happily, all across America, that did not similarly happen. We have something like I think an estimated 2,000 not-for-profit theaters spread across the country as part of this amazing movement that we've been part of.
Now you've written about the movement which started before your time here, back in the, you know, by some accounts in the 60s, there were definitely regional theaters before then, but the resident theater movement we know came out of the mid-60s, including TCG was part of that. Coming in midstream in the mid-80s, what if you could speak broadly about the last 30 years, any trends you've seen, whether the trend has been upward or downward? I know in the 80s, arts funding was a big fight. And since
it's still
then,
a big fight.
It's still a big fight, yeah. I don't know if you speak broadly about the field.
Yeah, probably not.
That's a big question. We'll be here all day.
How's it been?
How is it? Well, I don't know. There are any number of trends you could begin to track, but, you know, it's a time of transition in the field as well as here at American Theater. That's as exemplified by the story you just mentioned, you know, in Minneapolis. So that's a big change. Founders are passing on their legacy to a new generation and so forth. I'm particularly interested in the musical theater, as I know you are.
Yeah.
And trend I like to give a shout out to is the chamber musical. I think that's a wonderful development and a direction that that's terrific in the theater.
Yeah, like Fun Home would be the signature success, you know, that we can point to right now, the chamber musical.
Right.
Like literally, there's chamber musicians on stage and a pianist. So small scale. So
that's right.
No, it's when you think about the 80s. Just if you want to talk about just musical theater, it's in such better shape than it was in the 80s when it was all British invasions and Chorus Line was limping along.
Absolutely. You know, and wonderful new developments.
I think it's all over the country. There's theaters that's all of them seem to, a lot of theaters seem to have new play development, but a lot of them also seem to have new musical development programs all over the country, from San Jose, Palo Alto, the South, and New York.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe part of that change of musical theater has to do with more of nonprofits being involved with the commercial realm.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
I think so.
Absolutely.
I think there was just a concerted effort around the 80s and 90s of people to go, musical theater, it's one of the great American forms. We should be supporting it and finding new voices. And I think it's paying off now.
Absolutely.
I mean, the trend I would notice, this is your interview, but... But, you know, we have an interview that we banked up from TCG with Mark Valdez from the Network of Ensemble Theaters. And I think one thing you've seen is that the resident theater movement that we knew with the Guthrie and the big Lort theaters is still the bedrock of it. But there's a lot of other theaters outside the mold. I mean, the best example I can think of is the one I just went to Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And Bill Rausch came up in a theater that was... It was explicitly designed to be one outside the institutional theaters. He did in the 80s. That's when Cornerstone founded, about a couple years after this magazine. They didn't see the institutional theaters doing theater that mattered and was relevant, and they wanted to go outside. And I think it's not just that he's gotten older and now can run a giant theater, but also the theater has changed. The theater's more diverse. It's not as diverse as it needs to be. But I think a lot of those artists who train themselves, Joe Hodge, who's going to take over the Guthrie's, also from that generation of, like, I guess early Gen X, you might call it. They were taking over from the boomers, and their background is in ensemble theater. It's different from the old company model, but it's still ensemble driven. It's collaborative. It's devised. It's more diverse. I mean, we're hopeful. I think there's hopeful signs of life outside the institutional theaters, and some of that life is coming back into the
institutional theaters. I love it when institutional theaters adopt ensembles and bring those looser, more varied principles into their work.
But wasn't there ensembles in the 60s in downtown New York with the Wooster Group and the Performance Garage?
But
it wasn't like a national in scope. There weren't ensembles like Rude Max in Austin.
No, exactly. And Bill and Cornerstone looked to things like Wooster Group as being the models of like, this is an ensemble that did their own thing outside the institutional theaters. And then, was occasionally embraced by them. Steppenwolf might be another model that's, of course, started as an ensemble of actors and now is a giant Lort theater.
But it's still an ensemble-based theater.
Yeah, no, definitely. So there's those trends. I mean, and institutional theaters are still not the only way that work is legitimized. There's still great work on a small scale that's done all over the country, and we've covered that.
I think if you American theater has become the documentation of all those developments. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can it's truly amazing to open up some of those earlier issues and see the range and the excitement that was contained in those pages.
Well, yeah, and names that we take for granted as both huge names, but also names that are alternative names. They're sort of legendary. Jack Smith, mm-hmm. to Wendy Wasserstein, or Ron Vauder, Paul Zaloom. Great names.
Do you notice that there's more new plays being developed now?
Well, sure. Don't you think so?
I think there's a lot of new play, much like the new musical attention. I think new play development has become a thing. It's become a whole concern area of the field in a way that I don't think it was back in the day.
Right? And that's really unique to America.
The playwright being central.
The playwright's centrality is a unique thing. It's just not so in many other theater cultures.
Well, there's a big, when I went down to Bogota for that festival, there was a big trend of the playwright also being the director,
right.
Which seems rare in the U.S., mm-hmm. but it seems more mm-hmm. prevalent That's outside true. The U.S. It's kind of like a filmmaker model.
Right, auteur. So I don't want to brush aside the concerns of the field, but I wanted to ask about the magazine itself over the years. Mm-hmm. It's gone through a few redesigns. We added mm-hmm. color at some point. The staff got bigger than two.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering if you just talk about, some of the highlights and people over the years who you've met along the way. I know people, we like to talk about how TCG, Tony Kushner worked here for a while, Young Gene Lee, but a lot of folks have come through the magazine that are still part of the field.
Absolutely. The magazine is over the years has been a catalog of great collaborators and many wonderful journalists, writers, and critics have passed through. I could name a few of them. I mean, early on, Jan Stewart, who's a longtime theater and film critic for Newsday and other publications, was with the magazine. Kathleen Hulser, the historian, was here. The great Steve Druckmann, who's become a playwright, was on the magazine staff.
And we published his play, Prince of Atlantis, a few
years ago. That's right. Sort of full circle. Stephen Nuns, who now heads the graduate acting department at Towson University in Baltimore, was our sort of government reporter for many years. Steve's now working on a biography of Lee Brewer. Folks from Yale, Mark Robinson and Catherine Sheehy, were part of American Theater staff. Then, of course, I have to mention Todd London, whose article is a headliner in this September issue. More about that later. But let me think of other collaborators. Doug Langworthy, who works for Denver Center Theater Company, he's a dramaturg and translator and a great pal. A wonderful guy who I haven't kept track of, a small-town newspaper guy named Jack Savage, was a wonderful collaborator for a time on the magazine. Michelle Pierce, Stephanie Cohen, the great Randy Jenner, who was with the magazine for 8 years. More recently, Eliza Bent. Now Deep and Susie are on the staff, and here you are. You've been with us for 6 years.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, I'm proud to say I was freelancing for you from L.A. before then. Mm-hmm. You know, so I feel like I came into the field not long after it was founded. Mm-hmm. I mean, I graduated from college in 90, so I was already reading the magazine by the early 90s. So I came in early.
And then,
so did Susie.
I did too. I mean, technically, I started at American Theater before Rob, if you count my internship.
That's true.
Susie was an intern. Yes,
I was an intern. I know a lot about the field based on that book, editing the American Theater.
Oh, yes. I'm just glancing at the American Theater Reader, Essays and Conversations from American Theater Magazine, which we published on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of the magazine.
Right.
Was that 11 years ago?
No,
six years ago.
Yeah.
How old are we now?
Something like that.
We're about 31 now.
31 years old, yeah. The magazine is.
Yeah.
And,
I was working on it 7 or 8 years ago, yeah. So it must have published that's it right. after that.
And perhaps for the last 15 of those years, its designer has been the inimitable Kitty Suen,
yeah.
who is, who makes the magazine beautiful every month and, without whom we wouldn't know what to do.
Well, Jim, you've been a great leader and a great editor for many, many years, and you will be missed, but you will still be part of our team.
As soon as this issue is over, I'll begin to be able to think about what I'm going to do. But I definitely planned from my new headquarters in New Orleans to be writing for the magazine, continuing to write for the magazine, and perhaps more than I do at the present moment, and for other publications as well.
Can you say a little bit about what you'll be doing next in your life?
Very little.
Okay.
It's called retirement, Rob.
Yeah, right, that's true.
He's moving to New Orleans.
I'm moving to New Orleans. My sisters and I have also inherited a small farm, 110-acre farm in central Louisiana that we'll be working with in various ways.
Okay.
I don't know exactly where that project's going to go.
Okay.
American Theater Staff Retreat.
On an American Theater Staff Retreat sounds like a lovely idea. I'm going to be editing the Stephen Nunn's biography of Lee Brewer.
Okay.
Who knows what else.
You have plenty to do. You'll have time to relax, too. You deserve it.
Right? Perhaps.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine you relaxing too much for too long.
That's right.
And can you point out some of your favorite articles? Or subjects that we've covered in the past? Cornerstone or?
Yeah, I suppose I have my favorites that I remember. Our Cornerstone coverage over the years has been extraordinary. It began with Robert Coe's wonderful piece about their early project in Port Gibson, Mississippi, mm-hmm. the interracial Romeo and Juliet that was on the cover of
that
the
is
magazine.
My favorite piece in that American Theater Reader.
Isn't that a great piece? Mm-hmm. That's terrific. And our coverage of Cornerstone, I mean, it amounts to, I mean, we're headed for a new piece on Bill Rausch now.
Yeah. But we covered when Michael John Garces came in 2010, we put them on
totally,
the cover as well.
Totally. So, so that's a wonderful piece of history that you can glean from the magazine. Speaking of Todd London, he wrote a series of sort of pop psychology articles about the theater back in the 90s that are just treasures. They appear now in not in the American Theater Reader, but in Todd's own books that he's published with No Passport Press. I'm quite fond of a lot of the work that Don Shuey has done for the magazine. Don's a wonderful New York critic and reporter. His account of his early report of Mabu Mines was one of the longest and most thorough pieces that we published early in the magazine. And Don went on to write wonderful essays, a piece on the erotics of acting, profiles of innumerable important artists and so forth. It's really hard to zero in on these pieces. There are so many of them, but that's just a few.
It's 335 issues, is that right? Is that
something,
the number?
Something
I think
like
Terry
that.
Was saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
They'll all be online at some point.
Yeah, we're planning to put all this online at
yes,
some point. We're
going
to go
yes.
back in time. We have up through 2013?
14.
We're working on it. Archives will be available online. So I'm looking forward to rereading and posting these stories at
yes,
some point.
That's right.
So, well, at this point in our podcast, we do recommendations or small little topics that we want to.
Or maybe we can we can also talk about like your trip to OSF and what we've been doing lately, because Jim just went to Cutting Ball.
Well, I was just up at, not Cutting Ball, but Double Edge.
Sorry.
Double Edge.
Asheville, Massachusetts, to see their new piece, which is quite fantastic. I was just also last month in Beijing, China, where I was covering the advent of a two-performance Beijing opera engagement coming at Lincoln Center in early September.
What is it?
It's the two plays are called The Legend of the White Snake and The Jewelry Purse. These are classic Beijing operas starring a remarkable diva, opera diva, who's become a virtual pop star in China. And this will be her first performance outside China. And she's coming to Lincoln Center. Her name is Zheng Huoding. And she's quite an amazing performer. My coverage of that trip and her performance will also be in the September issue of American Theater. So that's sort of my recommendation, anticipating these wonderful Beijing operas at Lincoln Center.
What'd you see at Double Edge?
The show at Double Edge, called Once in a Blue Moon, is a Latin American-based piece. And the first time, Double Edge usually does classics like The Odyssey or Scheherazade, stories that everyone knows. Well, this is a new original piece that uses a lot of Latin American literature, Borges, Octavio Paz, and so forth, but it's also based on the personal experiences of their lead Argentinian actor, Carlos Cironia, who is a wonderful actor and a co-artistic director of the company and the lead actor in this piece. And it draws on his personal experiences in Argentina and coming to America. It also relates a lot to environmental issues having to do with flooding and economic development in Latin America. Quite a terrific piece, which is going to have a long life, I think, in Double Edge.
Like they perform out of a farm in Massachusetts. So
well, they live at a farm. Oh, large scale paintings, quite impactful. It's a promenade kind of performance where you
Around.
You walk around. The entire audience follows. Entire audience follows the company around from space to space, witnessing scene after scene, sometimes indoors, sometimes outdoors.
I edited and fact-checked for the magazine when I worked here was a wonderful in-depth piece about Double Edged from 2009. You can look it up on our old site. It's not on our new site yet, tcg.org.
Was it about the Grand Parade? Was that the one?
Well, I think that was the hook for it, but it was a whole piece about their work.
Yeah, we've covered the Grand Parade separately, but we also talk about Double Edge.
Yeah, the whole ethos of the company is fascinating. I would just say that I was just in Ashland, Oregon for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Only my second trip there since Bill Rausch began in 2006 or 7. One of the pieces in this American Theater Reader, it was my interview with Bill when he was leaving Cornerstone and going to Oregon. Two companies that you couldn't think of as more different. And so I just wanted to see what he's up to there. And he's made a lot of changes at Oregon. He's tried to turn this classic repertory theater festival into a new play powerhouse. And he has, to some extent, all the way made it to Broadway last year, but minus his company. So there's a lot of things about the way Oregon Shakes works as a sort of tourist destination. That's this well-oiled machine that he's not trying to ruin that, but he's trying to stretch it. And there's been challenges along the way in stretching that, stretching the company and the way that it does work. I saw Lynn Nottage premiere their Sweat, which we can look forward to. It's going to come to the arena next spring and probably to a New York venue in the summer or fall before the election. It's a politically themed play. I was very upset, disappointed that there are wildfires on the nearby hills in the Rogue Valley where Ashland is. And this happened a couple years ago where they had to cancel outdoor performances. So the play I was most looking forward to, I would say, was Jeff Witte's new musical based on an Elizabethan prose poem, Arcadia, with the music of the Go-Go's, which I'd read on the page. And I'd heard positive and negative things about the actual show from various people. But I'd read it on the page, thought it was great, couldn't wait to hear it. Has Michelle Maisie's in it. She's a great performer, and lots of other people. And it was canceled. We all filed into the theater, sat there, looked at the set at the Elizabethan Theater, beautiful outdoor theater, and the managing director had to come out and say, it was pretty smoky. We could definitely smell the fires. And so it's just not safe to perform. So,
did everyone get refunds? Like, what happens?
Yeah, I believe so. But of course, if you're press and you've flown from New York, I don't know. I can't get a refund on the whole trip. But it's okay. There's a possibility, given the pedigree of those involved, that Head Over Heels will come to other places at some point in the future. But who knows? I hope one day I'll be able to see it on tape or somewhere. Or hear a note of it. I didn't hear how did the Go-Go sound in that space, you know?
No, should have given your private performance. American Theater occasionally all the way over there.
Bill Rausch has said that occasionally they have done readings at music stands. And I was hoping that might happen, but I don't think this is too complicated a show to do that way. So, I know that some other New York critics are going there next week because there's a Lynn Nottage world premiere and a Go-Go's musical. So you can read some coverage if the wildfires don't shut down the Go-Go show again. You'll read some coverage in the national press about these. And my story, a big story about Oregon and Bill and what they're doing in the October issue.
How does Lynn feel about Charles Isherwood coming to review her play?
Well, I didn't say that that's happening.
It's kind of a contentious issue whenever he chooses to go into the regions.
Well, we didn't actually say that, but yes, that is happening. And it is contentious, but for the company feels like, we're getting coverage from the New York Times. We're putting on a world premiere play. That's great. That's what we want. Why is the work not ready to be reviewed? But of course, playwrights don't always feel that way. That's a whole other can of worms. You can look on our site for Tim Sanford of Playwrights Horizons wrote an essay about this and talked to the Times about this. And, I think there's a lot of merit to both sides of the issue. But I know a lot of people in the resident theaters around the country have many feelings about it. I've talked to artistic directors who definitely believe a play should not be reviewed by the New York Times until it's in New York. But other artistic directors at major theaters feel like we're doing great work here. We're putting on a new play by a national playwright, and the Times is interested in it. Why would we not want a Times review? So you have this politics where the artistic director of a hypothetical theater, let's say, would love to have Times coverage of all the great work they're doing. But the artists they brought in. This is one of the issues that happens when you turn your play into your resident theater into a new play powerhouse, like as New Orleans tried to do. You get national attention. So what do you do with that? So hopefully I'll be able to sort that out.
If something is selling tickets, you can review it.
Of course, in principle. But it's a question of when is a play locked? Chris Ashley at La Jolla Playhouse was telling me he does not like the trend either. And he runs a major resident theater.
That does pre-Broadway engagements and stuff.
Right.
Because when I was at the Critics Institute at the O'Neill and Charles Isherwood came, it was like this aura of, oh my goodness, he's coming and we don't want him to see any of the work that's here because it's not ready yet. And Steve Sater's new play, like he was going to go to the reading of it and they wouldn't let him in because they have visions for New York for that play.
Right.
And then I've talked to so many other playwrights that says he killed my play by reviewing it in the regions and now no one else wants to do it. And so
he's also champion plays. I mean, people love it when he writes a good review.
Yeah, so like you take the good and the bad. At the same time, it's something that I brought up when I was there. Is there something pernicious about the theater that will take an Isherwood review that's negative and use it as a reason to not do this new play or give it a second production?
Well, the people like Isherwood and Frank Rich and Brantley almost universally take the position that it's the power of the Times is they're not responsible for that. It's the power of the Times.
Right.
And it's simply a fact of the centrality of the theater in New York. It's a complicated question.
I mean, I think the Times is just trying to provide the best arts coverage they can, and Charles and doing his job. And
yeah, I would say that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel it's very complicated. I've talked to Tim Sanford and said, look, if you want to produce that play, you should produce that play, no matter what the time said. But it's not that easy, because sometimes plays have investors, right? Or yeah, and then, Tim Sanford's not the best example, but sometimes a play that has commercial aspirations can be influenced by those out-of-town reviews. So I do see both sides of it, and I don't know the answer. I think if you're putting up a play and you're charging for tickets, then in principle, anyone can come to review it. I will say this, and I don't want to talk about personalities in general, but I will say I really like what Charles McNulty does at the LA Times. He is very conscious that he is often the first eyes on a piece that is, maybe has Broadway aspirations or just further aspirations from outside. And he has a background as a dramaturg. And I know that some people don't want to get advice from a critic, but he writes reviews which are very conscious of his position. He does not write the review as if this is a final product. What you got for me? Don't like this, like that, don't like. He writes it more as
Chris Jones is the same way.
Yeah, I think both of them do. And I think that that's a responsible way to do it. I wish that that were more the attitude, especially of a paper with the national reach of the New York Times. But you can't tell a critic how to write. So and I'm not the editor of those folks. So
I mean, there has always been a divide between artist and critic. Like, that has always been a contentious point in the industry. That's not something new.
Well, there should be. That's their job. Yeah.
There is a divide, but then I somehow feel like back when, in the 60s, when it was mostly Broadway coming out into the region, now it's more like a play will get will get multiple rounds before it goes to New York, it'll get a first round in major theater, and then Charles will come review it, and then that will kill the play dead, and they won't get any more productions, even though it never came to New York.
That is not Charles's fault.
Well,
I'm not saying it's Charles's fault, but I feel like it's a more complicated ecosystem now.
Rolling world premieres are good for, just National New Play Network, but there's other folks who do co-productions to help mitigate some of that. I mean, Lynn's play is going to Arena no matter what, and almost definitely going to New York, although no one's announced the theater yet. Theater's putting faith in these artists and producing their work no matter what the critics say is how it should be.
Yeah.
Right? It's just that New York still reserves power to ratify. And I'm not just New York critics, but New York production. If you have a production in New York. I mean, I know some people will get a production in New York, no matter how it's reviewed, just to say it played in New York. And that somehow leads to more productions around the country.
Give it legitimacy.
But I mean, for one, am excited that the writers of that caliber are going out to OSF because I enjoy reading them. I enjoy the Times, and it'll help me learn about something
I
can't go to.
Well, that's why, to mention another critic, Terry Teachout is going to Oregon, as he's often gone before, specifically to see Lynn's play. He's very excited about that. I don't think he's as excited about the Go-Go's. I can't speak for Terry, but I'm sure that Charles is, because Charles is a huge fan. Charles is a huge fan of Rock of Ages. And Michelle Mays, who's in Head Over Heels, was one of the stars of Rock of Ages. Or one of the chorus, but she's great.
American theater has dealt with the issue of criticism and its power and legitimacy many times. As I thumb through the American theater readers we're talking here, I would suggest you go to November 1985 to read Eric Bentley's essay, How Free is Too Free. move on to July, August 87 to read Julius Novick's piece, The Critical Instinct. Yeah. Check out perhaps the June 1999 issue where Robert Brustein and Frank Rujo in conversation on that subject. There are any number of...
It's definitely been a theme that comes up, and we could cover it every issue because we're interested in it, but we try to dole it out. Hey, David Cody did a great piece for us about
critics who are also artists. Yes.
Critics who are also artists, but also a couple years ago, one where he rounded up the last critic standing in various regional papers around the country, and it was a great roundup. Actually, it was a great way to spot some talent, too.
Yeah, and then we also, we talked in the previous podcast, the one you did last year, Humana, about, was it last year? Yeah, I think it was last year, when Lauren Gunnison gave that address at the American Critics, Theater Critics Association about how the Rolling World premiere helped her make the play better, because if people just went off of the first review of I and You, it would have no one else would have produced that play because the reviews were not good.
But in that case, which is great, like a co-production or a rolling premiere, even if the reviews are not good, and maybe it's a Charles type reviewer, where Charles McNulty type reviewer, where they give you advice or you get some feedback, and if you know you have a second production, maybe that's a helpful tool for you as an artist.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like for artists, it's helpful when other companies have already committed to producing your play a second time, but then when no one else has, and this is the first time it's going to get done,
right?
And then a big theater critic comes in and reviews it. It's just an unfortunate ecosystem that it behooves.
It's an economic system. People are here to make money, and it's a critic's job to write for their readers.
No one makes money in the regional theater.
Critics are there for their readers to tell them whether it's worth their money to spend on the show.
Yeah, look, I think it behooves anyone developing new work to think about the path of development. And if they want to do development outside the critical ecosystem, they have to think about that. But when they take it to a resident theater and they're a major playwright, they're going to get attention and reviews. They're going to get reviewed. And if they work at Powerhouse or they work at Sundance, they're not going to get reviewed. They're going to O'Neill, they're not going to get reviewed. But at a certain point, their work is going to be subject to review. So I don't know a way around that. If they're going to do it at a resident theater that sells tickets, open to the public.
That's really interesting, though, that at the O'Neill they wouldn't even let Charles into it, because you can buy tickets to that. Like, he could have bought a ticket as a human and seen it.
As a human? He could have gone in disguise.
He's just not wearing beards or glasses when he goes into the theater.
You don't need to edit that. He could have just bought a ticket.
He'd be like Ruth Reichel, who put on disguises.
Wells, the New York Times, a food critic, and want his picture taken on social media.
Wasn't it Ruth Reichel at the Times who would go in disguise to restaurants?
So did Biff Grimes when he did it.
Wonderful. You guys have any recommendations or thoughts to close out?
I don't know if it's a recommendation, but I'm seeing a play tonight by Yusuf Al-Gundi called Threesome at 5959. It was produced at a contemporary theater before and a contemporary theater in Seattle and that Portland Center stage in Oregon.
Okay, right.
And so I'm excited for that. It's about a Muslim American couple who invites a third party into their bed. And so it deals with some very heavy topics of sexuality and religion and politics and the Middle Eastern treatment of women.
Right.
I've never seen his work before, so this might be interesting. I don't know if I'll recommend it, but that's what I'm doing tonight.
He's good. We published him a couple years ago. Now I can't remember the name of a couple.
Musif and Sherry in the New World.
That's it.
That's right.
And I saw a wonderful play of his at the Flea many years ago called Back of the Throat, which is my favorite post-September 11th play.
Yeah, that's the only play of his I know.
It's really good. Yeah.
I have a show I'm really excited about that I haven't seen yet, and then I'll have a recommendation, I guess. Dear Evan Hansen just opened at Arena Stage, and we did a preview piece with the star Ben Platt. Just got a really brave review in the Washington Post from Peter Marks.
And Charles Isherwood review.
I haven't read the Charles Isherwood review yet.
I can look it up right now.
I'm really excited about it. I mean, I'm big fans of Dogfight and love that music, and Stephen Levinson's a great playwright who wrote the book, and so very excited about making it out to D.C. this August to go see that. And then, I guess as a recommendation, I've been doing a lot of thinking about Hamilton lately, because we did that big Lynn piece. I've seen it twice now.
What's this again?
Broadway.
Hamilton, what's that?
But there's these really fun videos. They do this show at the lottery called the Ham for Ham Show.
Uh-huh.
And if you go to Lynn's Twitter feed, or our friend Howard Sherman has videoed a lot of them, you can see a lot of these really great, like, street theater from the show with cast members, and it's really fun to watch. I mean, Andy Blankenbuehler just did a number and danced his own choreography. Like, they had In the Heights reunion. It's cool stuff. It's worth watching.
They just do this in the lobby or on the street there?
They do it on the street, just in front of the theater.
Wow.
So check those videos out. They're fun.
So should we show up early? I'm going to see Hamilton tomorrow night. Should I show up early for the Ham for Ham show?
You got to be there at 5:55.
Okay, I will not be there. I'll be having dinner.
Is a Ham for Ham, is it people line up for lottery tickets are $10? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a little show for like lottery contestants. So you can get a front row seat for $10. About 800 people submit every day. So you probably won't win it.
Wow.
They line up on the block.
It starts at 5:30 for the lottery to put your name in. And they do the little Ham for Ham show at 5:55, and they do the drawing at 6.
Yeah, I'm seeing it tomorrow for the matinee. I'm very excited. Are we all seeing it?
I'm seeing it. I saw it last night. Yeah.
How did you get in twice?
My parents paid for tickets the first time, and then I got press tickets.
Looking forward to it.
Well, this is the first of these podcasts that I've participated in, and I can't believe anyone would be interested in listening to all of us for this amount of time. I'm totally astonished.
So,
well, we didn't
listen to this, Jim.
Are you sure?
Yes.
All right.
That's a perfect note, I think, to end this.
Yeah, we're almost at 50 minutes.
So we've managed to talk about many things, Jim. But hopefully this won't be the last one you're on. Maybe
all right.
We can get you on the phone
all right.
from New Orleans all right. when you visit. So go to us on iTunes, rate us, and thanks for listening.
Goodbye.